SDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
So now my successors, I fear forevermore, are going to be wholly dependent on the good graces of the president.
We speak with the fired head of a federal watchdog agency. He abandoned the legal fight to get his job back.
For Friday, March 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A federal law called the FACE Act prohibits intentionally interfering with people providing or receiving reproductive health care services.
The Justice Department now says it is scaling back enforcement.
It basically tells them that there will be no consequences for them to come into our centers and potentially even be violent.
And the waters of the Arctic are home to narwhals.
Scientists are studying these whales, which have long, sharp tusks.
It almost seems like it was the strongest proof that unicorns really did exist.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says when it comes to interest rates, the central bank will likely stand pat in the months ahead. Powell saying proposed changes by the administration, including to taxes, government spending, immigration, and regulation, are not yet clear, though he said overall the U.S. economy is holding up well.
Despite elevated levels of uncertainty, the U.S. economy continues to be in a good place. The labor market is solid, and inflation has moved closer to our 2% longer-run goal. At the Fed, we are intently focused on our dual mandate goals given to us by Congress, maximum employment and stable prices.
Powell said the net effect of the administration's changes will matter for the U.S. economy and Fed interest rate policy. Maryland's attorney general is leading a coalition of 20 AGs in a lawsuit over the firing of federal employees. Scott Massioni of member station WYPR reports the lawsuit argues the Trump administration did not follow laws regulating large-scale federal reductions in workforce.
Maryland Attorney General Anthony Brown says the firings will cause irreparable burdens and expenses on the states and have forced workers into financial insecurity.
According to public reports, the Trump administration has fired roughly 23,000 probationary employees over the past 3 weeks. Not because they were bad at their jobs or because they didn't do important work, but simply because the president will do anything to eliminate federal workers.
The White House says it's cutting government waste. Brown has followed up with a motion for a temporary restraining order seeking to stop any more firings and to reinstate those who have been dismissed. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni.
Officials in Ukraine say more drone and missile strikes by Russia overnight targeted key energy facilities and the electrical grid. While many of the missiles and drones were intercepted, officials say at least 10 people were hurt. Comes just days after the U.S. suspended military aid and intelligence to Ukraine in an effort to force the country to accept a peace deal with Russia. Walgreens says it's ending its run as a public company after nearly 100 years. The pharmacy chain has reached a deal to be taken private in a massive leveraged buyout by a private equity firm called Sycamore Partners. NPR's Alina Saliuk has more.
Walgreens Boots Alliance has been spiraling, losing billions of dollars, sales declining for years. The business of brick-and-mortar pharmacies has gotten expensive. The chain has expanded a huge physical footprint, but now faces intense competition from Walmart and Amazon and grocery stores, plus constant changes to how it gets paid to fill prescriptions. Last year, Walgreens said a quarter of its stores did not make money. It's been closing hundreds of locations. The chain's foray into primary care clinics proved too pricey and time-consuming. The chain now hopes, as a private company without pressure to report quarterly results, it might be able to get more leeway and more time to stage a turnaround. Alina Seluk, NPR News.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today, though indices were down for the week. This is NPR. With the spring and summer travel seasons approaching, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is asking doctors and public health officials to be on the lookout for signs of illness that comes with rash and fevers. The health alert comes amid an ongoing measles outbreak in Texas and New Mexico. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
The CDC says thanks to high vaccination rates and strong surveillance programs, the risk for widespread measles in the United States remains low. It emphasizes that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine remains the most important tool for preventing measles. The agency is urging all U.S. residents to make sure they're up to date with their measles vaccinations, especially before traveling anywhere internationally. That includes infants 6 months or older who are traveling abroad. The CDC says teens and adults in areas with an ongoing measles outbreak who previously only got one dose of measles vaccine should get a second dose. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Meeting with leaders of the cryptocurrency industry at a first-of-its-kind White House summit today, President Trump said he's committed to helping the industry. Trump says he wants to make the U.S. a world leader in cryptocurrencies by creating a so-called federal Bitcoin reserve. Trump says the U.S. already has Bitcoin seized through enforcement actions and wants to build on that.
The Treasury and Commerce Departments will also explore new pathways to accumulate additional Bitcoin holdings for the reserve, provided it's done at no cost to the taxpayers. We don't want any cost to the taxpayers.
Trump also promised friendly legislation and less regulation of cryptocurrency under his administration. The cryptocurrency industry was a significant contributor to Trump's reelection campaign. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. What happens when a whistleblower claims wrongdoing in the federal government, or abuse of power, or waste of funds? Who investigates those allegations, and who protects those federal employees? The answer is one independent watchdog agency called the Office of Special Counsel. President Trump fired the head of the Office of Special Counsel shortly after he took office. Since then, Special Counsel Hampton Dellinger has been locked in a legal fight with the administration. That is a fight that he just gave up. Dellinger is here in the studio with me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
So I just want to start by giving our listeners a little bit of context here. You took over the Office of Special Counsel in March of last year, being appointed by then-President Biden. President Trump fired you last month, and that's something that a president does have the power to do. You sued. One judge declared that firing unlawful and put you back on the job. But then this week, another court allowed your removal to go through. A lot of back and forth there. I want to start with this question. Why are you giving up this fight to regain your job now?
Two reasons. One, I recognize that the trio of judges who decided to sideline me are somewhat conservative, and in that sense mirror our United States Supreme Court. So I do think the odds of me ultimately prevailing may have been long, and even more, it would have literally taken a long time, and it could have been up to a year. And I've seen the damage that is being done to federal agencies on a day-by-day, even hour-by-hour basis, and I didn't think I could in any meaningful way pick up the pieces a year from now, even if I prevailed.
I'm curious, just internally, what got you to that point of saying, you know, I'm going to step back, I'm not going to continue pushing this? Was there a moment, a conversation?
Well, there was a judicial decision, and it was hard because when that came down 2 days ago, that morning, I had been able to get 6,000 newly hired federal employees back on the job. They had been unlawfully fired, in my estimation, based on the investigation I did. And I was ready to move forward and try and get all 100 or 200,000 probationary employees put back on the job because of their unlawful firing. And that night, the court made clear that I was going to lose my job, at least temporarily. And I think a little bit was going to make a huge difference in terms of my ability to ever be effective again.
You've kind of started to get into this, but in the statement that you put out announcing your decision, you wrote that taking this all the way to the Supreme Court was a long shot. Is it just the politics of the court?
Well, I don't know if they would see themselves as political, but their legal viewpoint is one that I disagree with. I recognize they are the final arbiters of the law. There was no question that my firing violated a law. A president has to have a very good reason to fire someone with the type of statutory protections I had. The only question is the law unconstitutional? And I think you have to have a view almost of the president as a king to believe that he should be able to fire anyone he wants, whenever he wants. That's not what Congress has believed. That's not what prior courts have believed. But I think this court would have likely found against me, and I feel like that's unfortunate.
I've been looking at some of the comments from conservative legal scholars and commentators, and they've made the case that this is an encroachment on the president's power to choose his agency heads if the ruling, I'm talking about the ruling to preserve your job. What do you make of those arguments?
Well, I'm not a legal scholar. I'm a lawyer. But I do know that every other branch of government has checks and balances. In the legislative branch, in Congress, you've got the House versus the Senate. In the judicial branch, you have federal and state courts, higher court, the highest court, the Supreme Court, and lower courts. And so the idea that our framers, who had fought a war against a king, would have set up the executive branch with no independence, no protection for watchdogs like myself, I don't think is what our framers had in mind. But at the end of the day, I know the Supreme Court controls, and even when I disagree with a decision or a viewpoint, I respect it. I think that's what Americans do.
And something you said in that statement as well, I'll just note. Now, before your firing and during that brief period in which you were reinstated, you've challenged the administration's firings of probationary federal employees. What evidence did you find that those firings may have been illegal?
Well, the evidence came from the agencies themselves. The president can reorganize the executive branch, can even downsize, but it has to be done according to regulations and rules, like the RIF rules, reductions in force, right. Or Congress has the power of the purse and could lessen the amount of money to the executive branch. But if you're going to fire federal employees, it needs to be done on an individualized assessment. And agencies were sending out these mass firing notices, in some instances claiming it was for performance, but there'd been no individualized assessment. I think it was not only unlawful, I think it was defamatory. And that's why I was so pleased that we were able to get 6,000 employees back on the job. And I think there's a legal basis for all of those terminated probationary employees to be put back on the job immediately. I hope agencies will do it voluntarily. All I have is my voice at this point. But I also think it's really important to understand that so many federal employees are military veterans. And so when you disrespect federal employees, you're disrespecting veterans.
Are you concerned that your successor will run into roadblocks trying to investigate claims that are brought to the Office of Special Counsel, or just not even try?
I am, because it was so critical, I think, to the success of my office, not just when I was there, but going back 50 years when the office was first created. It was so vital that whistleblowers who may already have been mistreated by their agencies felt that they could go to a safe place outside their agencies, have someone with the experience of looking into claims and someone able to protect them. And the independence of my office was key. So now my successors, I fear forevermore, are going to be wholly dependent on the good graces of the president. And I just don't think that can ever work in the same way it had before. And I think it had worked well before.
You end your statement with this line, and I'm going to quote it. "While I've given up on continuing to serve as special counsel, I retain my unyielding belief in the rule of law in America and the promise of our indispensable nation. I trust that as long as we cherish these vital precepts, they will exist," end quote. In light of that line, are you feeling hopeful in this moment?
I am, and I'm not. Certainly, we've seen presidents push the limits of their authority before, but I've talked to many people who say they've never seen the types of things we're seeing now, including these mass terminations of so many hardworking federal employees. But the courts are still there. Congress has a voice, has the power of the purse, and I hope they will use it. And I've seen so many Americans care about what's going on. So as daunting as the present seems, I still have hope. I think we have to have hope for the future.
That is Hampton Dellinger, now former special counsel. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Three simple ingredients, olive oil, water, and lye, have been combined for centuries to make soap in the Palestinian city of Nablus in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. The city has become known for it. The tradition has passed down from generation to generation, and recently it was added to UNESCO's list of intangible cultural heritage. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf visited one of the oldest soap factories and brings us this report.
It's around 7 a.m., and the old city of Nablus is waking up for the day, including at the Tukan soap factory, right off the main square, where a powerful furnace has just been lit, the flames blasting, heating a giant vat of hundreds of gallons of waxy liquid above it. It's a morning ritual that has been happening here for more than 150 years. Musa Asachil scrapes a metal spatula through the mixture, which has been boiling on and off for several days, checking the consistency. He flips a switch, and a big metal blade starts mixing it, sloshing the thickening goop onto surrounding surfaces. Asachil has been in charge of this process, cooking the soap, for 45 years. He says his father had the job before him. It's a job that gives me joy, he says, doing something the way my ancestors did it. There used to be dozens of soap factories like this in Nablus. Now there are only a few. This one, Tukan, is one of the oldest, open since 1872.
We are producing soap using our traditional way.
Nail Kubash has been managing operations for more than 30 years. He says here at the factory, barely anything has changed. I ask if the same can be said for outside the factory, in Nablus and in the West Bank. And he just laughs. He switches to Arabic. Over the past three decades, he says, we have had to deal with increasing military impediments, referring to the roadblocks, checkpoints, and raids that are part of the Israeli military occupation here. It's hard for life, he says, but it's also hard for business. People sometimes can't get to work or product can't be delivered. The day before our visit, the Israeli military raided the old city of Nablus as part of what it calls an extended counterterrorism operation in the West Bank. The factory kept operating, but it's disruptive and dangerous, says Kubash. They've had to lay off workers, and production has decreased by about a third. But we want to keep the legacy alive, he says. We head upstairs with assistant manager Sultan Kudra. The top level is a wide open room with a slick cement floor. When the soap mixture is ready, after about 7 days of boiling, porters carry it up here in metal buckets, spreading it on the floor to harden. Then it's cut into bars using long pieces of thread. Those bars are then stacked in high towers throughout the room to dry for 3 months. The final step in the process can be heard from the next room. A rhythmic flutter. Men sit on the ground, surrounded by bars of soap, wrapping each one by hand in paper. Kudra says they can wrap about 1,000 bars per hour. We call this soap the white gold of Nablus, Kudra says with a smile. I ask what he thinks about the UNESCO recognition. We're really proud, he says. We work so hard to preserve this history. It's not just soap, he says. It's part of our identity. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Nablus.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19. The CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. For more than 30 years, there has been a federal law on the books known as the FACE Act. It prohibits intentional interference with people either providing or receiving reproductive health care services, including abortions. Now, the Justice Department says it is sharply scaling back enforcement of that law. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas looked into what this means for people on both sides of the abortion issue.
In late August of 2021, Phoebe Brandt was seeing patients at a Planned Parenthood facility in Philadelphia, where she works as a nurse practitioner. At a certain point that morning, she stopped by the front office and was told that a man had barricaded himself in one of the clinic's bathrooms.
I mean, at that very moment, we really didn't know what was going on. We didn't know if he was armed. We didn't know if he had a bomb on him. It was very scary just because we didn't know what was happening.
The clinic had to be evacuated. The man holed up in the bathroom was an anti-abortion activist named Matthew Connolly. He wasn't armed, but court papers say he refused to leave even after the police came. Eventually, a SWAT team broke down the door and took him away. Connolly's actions, though, forced the clinic to shut down for the day.
We had patients who had been in the middle of their visits who were standing around hoping to get back in. We're told, we're sorry, you have to go home. And then all of the other patients for the day had to be called and told not to come in.
Federal prosecutors brought a civil case under the FACE Act against Connolly, seeking to impose financial penalties and deter future violations, one of several such cases the Justice Department brought under the Biden administration. Now the Trump administration has moved to undo all of that. The Justice Department's new leadership says it will only enforce violations of the FACE Act in extraordinary circumstances, such as death or serious property damage. Local authorities can handle anything short of that. The department also dropped three pending FACE Act cases, including the one against Connolly. President Trump, meanwhile, pardoned 23 people convicted of violating the FACE Act. Abortion providers, including Brandt, think this gives a green light to anyone who wants to disrupt clinics in the future.
It basically tells them that there will be no consequences for them to come into our centers, disrupt things, and potentially even be violent.
The FACE Act was passed by Congress in 1994 with bipartisan support to prevent rising violence against abortion clinics and providers, including the 1993 murder of Dr. David Gunn by an anti-abortion extremist.
The FACE Act has been incredibly effective at curbing some of the major types of violence and obstruction that we saw really escalating in the early 90s.
That's Melissa Fowler from the National Abortion Federation. She says enforcement of the FACE Act has varied over the years, with Democratic administrations generally being seen as more active than Republican ones. But the Trump administration's decision to sharply limit enforcement of it, she says, is unprecedented.
It really shouldn't take an abortion provider being murdered for the federal government to enforce a law that has been effective at keeping providers safe and helping people access care.
For opponents of abortion, though, the department's decision is a source of optimism.
That decision is very much welcomed.
Monica Miller is the director of Citizens for a Pro-Life Society. She also was a defendant in one of the federal cases recently dropped by the Justice Department.
I've always felt very deeply that this was a flawed law. It was unfair. It went after a particular social justice group for higher penalties.
Some abortion opponents have called for a renewed push to disrupt clinics in light of the new FACE Act charging policy. For her part, Miller says the department's approach will make it easier to conduct disruptive actions at clinics. But she says activists can still face legal consequences under state law, so it's too soon to say how big of an effect it will have. Either way, abortion providers say they are already bracing for more activity and hostility at their clinics. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The cold waters of the Arctic are home to an unusual whale that you might have heard of, the narwhal. Narwhals have a long, sharp tusk that juts out of their heads. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, scientists recently used drones to spy on narwhals and were intrigued by how these whales seem to use their tusks.
The tusk that sticks out of a narwhal's head can be up to 10 feet long. Greg O'Corey Crow is a zoologist with Florida Atlantic University. He's gotten to see this tusk up close while working to tag narwhals with satellite trackers.
And it is quite an overwhelming experience to stand there in the water and help hold a live narwhal and sort of feel the tusk.
He says the tusk is beautiful.
It almost looks like it has been fashioned and carved. It has a lovely spiral scrolled pattern to it, so it's mesmerizing, really, in some ways.
Hundreds of years ago, seafarers brought these home and passed them off as unicorn horns.
It almost seems like it was the strongest proof that unicorns really did exist.
Why the narwhal tusk exists has long been of interest to scientists. The tusks are found almost exclusively on male narwhals. There's now a general consensus that the tusks play a role in competitive mating. A long tusk tells females that a male is large, fertile, and successful. The bigger, the better.
So I think in many ways we've sort of converged on that as the primary use, but it looks now like it has other uses.
He thinks that because he and some colleagues recently spied on groups of narwhals. They used small drones that could hover above the water and take video. They did this research in the summer. The water was clear enough to see down 15 feet or so. The narwhals seemed to be relaxed, just gently socializing.
Females were nursing calves. Males were hanging out in these sort of bachelor herds.
Some of the narwhals with tusks seem to use them in a playful way to explore or manipulate fish.
You know, mess with it with their tusk, flip it a few times, flip it again, you know, things like this. And then, you know, they return to each other as if saying, you know, you have a go, or, you know, this is what you do.
In the journal Frontiers in Marine Science, the researchers say narwhals could use their tusks to stun and possibly kill prey. They saw a narwhal repeatedly hitting a fish with its tusk. Courtney Watt is a scientist with Fisheries and Oceans Canada. She notes that females get food just fine without tusks, so she doesn't think this is why the males evolved to have them.
But I think maybe they've learned to use them to assist them with foraging.
One narwhal expert who didn't work on this study is skeptical. Kristen Lydra is a marine biologist with the University of Washington.
I think these are short-term videos that show a few narwhals at the surface, you know, moving their heads around in the vicinity of a fish. And whether it's play behavior or pursuit of that fish to consume it, nobody knows.
She says narwhal behavior remains largely unknown. There's almost no underwater observations.
There's so much we could learn if we could, you know, have images or video or something down there seeing their behavior and being able to record it.
But she says even if you could have an underwater drone, these skittish whales would no doubt be scared away. And for much of the year, narwhals are completely out of reach. They spend the long, dark Arctic winter far offshore, living beneath the sea ice, diving deep in frigid water. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Greg Gutfeld's late night show on Fox is a big draw of the Trump era, though the host says he never really thought of himself as political.
I've always been the odd man out, so that probably molded the way I view things as kind of an outsider.
That conversation plus Selma, 60 years after Bloody Sunday, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, a group of former Navy divers and special operations veterans.
They're called Force Blue, and they're trying to help vets who miss the camaraderie of service.
I was definitely lost at sea, and Force Blue has been an incredible boon. It's absolutely changed my life.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. As the Trump administration continues firing federal workers, those terminations are affecting Northwest tribes. Lauren Patterson of Northwest Public Broadcasting has the story.
Kylie Probert worked for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Her job was to help manage grants for tribal communities across the country. Last month, Probert was fired. She was managing more than a dozen of these grants, some up to $1 million over 5 years.
There was a big push to cut diversity-related projects at HHS. And of course, a lot of my work with tribes fell into that bucket.
The projects were temporarily halted, and Probert says she has no way to verify if the work will be restarted or renewed. The administration says it's cutting costs. But Probert has concerns about the long-term impact on public health initiatives and the well-being of tribal communities that rely on those programs. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Patterson in Orofino, Idaho.
New Mexico authorities have completed their autopsy on the cause of death for actor Gene Hackman and his wife last month. The 95-year-old Oscar winner's cause of death was heart disease and complications from Alzheimer's, while his 65-year-old wife Betsy died from hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. And today we learn she died 5 days before he did. Heather Jarrell is New Mexico's chief medical examiner.
Based on this information, it is reasonable to conclude that Mr. Hackman probably died around February 18th. Based on the circumstances, it is reasonable to conclude that Ms. Hackman passed away first, with February 11th being the last time that she was known to be alive.
Hantavirus is more common in the Southwest and can be contracted by exposure to mouse droppings that carry the virus. You're listening to NPR News. Thousands of people flooded the Lincoln Memorial today for the Stand Up for Science rally. NPR's Jonathan Lambert tells us they turned out to protest the Trump administration's cuts to science.
Neuroscientist and professor Michael Grubb traveled from Trinity College in Connecticut because he felt like he had to do something.
I had one student who's on the PhD market this year, you know, who was told by a couple of institutions that, you know, sorry, we're not taking PhD students this year.
Many of those at the rally are aspiring scientists worried about the current climate, including Chloe Autry, a master's student in chemistry at the College of William and Mary in Virginia.
All of the funding for my research is through the NSF, and we just applied for a new round of funding, and it was supposed to be reviewed in February, and everything got kind of shut down, so we're in limbo.
But she says she's heartened by the number of people who showed up to support science. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Well, it's that time again. Time to spring forward this weekend as daylight saving time ends early Sunday morning. We'll lose an hour of sleep, but gain an extra hour of daylight. Remember to set your clocks 1 hour ahead before bedtime Saturday, unless you live in Hawaii or parts of Arizona where they don't observe the time change. Stocks finished on a high note after a brutal trading week on Wall Street. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California. Okay, remember everybody, daylight saving time starts this weekend. That means clocks spring forward and we all lose an hour of sleep on Sunday. Ugh. Claire Marie Schneider of NPR's Life Kit has some tips to help you adjust to the time change. Hi, Claire Marie.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, I have to admit, I dread this time every year because I'm already a terrible morning person as it is. So that first day of getting up an hour early is really painful. I would love some strategies on how to prepare for this disruption to my sleep.
Yeah, I talked to Allison Harvey about this. She's a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's a sleep scientist and a licensed clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. And she talked about the importance of resetting your circadian rhythm. So basically letting your body's internal clock know when it's time to wake up and when it's time to sleep. So to start, she says try waking up 15 to 20 minutes earlier than usual tomorrow morning, Saturday morning.
Oh.
Then she says, on Sunday, wake up 30 to 40 minutes earlier than you normally would, which I know might sound hard, but Harvey says it is worth it.
It will really help Monday when most of us have to be somewhere. If tomorrow and Sunday people can be bringing the circadian clock forward. Now, what we're doing by moving the circadian clock in this way is cueing our whole sleep and circadian systems that it has to realign with this wake-up time.
Okay, so great. I just have to make the pain start earlier and wake up earlier. Is there anything else I can do to help this along?
Yeah, Harvey really emphasized how important it is to get outside when you wake up this weekend.
And even if you can't get outdoors, generally have the curtains open and try to spend some time outside, even on a cloudy day, just to get the outdoor light.
So again, that light is all in an attempt to reset your internal clock and let your body know, hey, we're making a change. Harvey said, get as much as you can. 20 minutes would be great, but if you can only swing a couple minutes outside, that's fine too.
Okay, so get that sunlight, wake up earlier. Keep going. What else should I do?
Yeah, so one final thing we talked about is trying to get ready for bed a bit earlier too. So just like you want to wake up earlier, you also want to signal to your body a little sooner than usual that it's time for bed.
So tonight, if it's we usually go to bed at 10 p.m., start that wind down at 9 p.m. And during the wind down, it would be dimming the lights and engaging in relaxing, sleep-enhancing activities so that we have a bit more chance of falling asleep a little bit earlier.
Okay, this all sounds great for people who plan ahead, but what if you are like me during some years, and you wake up Sunday morning and you've totally forgotten that the clocks had changed and you've done nothing to prepare. What do you do then?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think a lot of us will be in this camp. So here's what Seema Khosla, a sleep medicine physician in Fargo, North Dakota, had to say about that.
Don't panic. Have a normal day. Maybe do a little bit more exercise, do a little bit more something so you're a little bit sleepier so you can go to bed a little bit earlier. Remember, we get another chance to get it right tomorrow. You know, take that pressure off of yourself. Do the best you can do in that moment.
Okay, you can always suffer Monday morning instead. That is Life Kit producer Claire Marie Schneider. Thank you so much, Claire Marie.
Thank you, Elsa. I hope you sleep well this weekend.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. And if you're interested in more tips to help you sleep better, sign up for Life Kit's special newsletter at npr.org/sleepweek.
At
least 9,000 people have been forcefully evicted from a riverside community in Nigeria's most populous city, Lagos. Like many waterfront communities across the city, it has faced multiple threats and been targeted by luxury real estate developers. A high court order prohibited any eviction without relocating residents, yet they still woke up on Friday to demolition equipment and armed men, as NPR's Emmanuel Akinwoji reports.
A train of hundreds of people make their way through narrow streets. They clutch whatever they can hold, walking under the weight of mattresses, suitcases, and bags of clothes carried on their heads. Dust hangs in the air and blurs the chaos in a riverside inner-city community called Ilaje Otumara, which first settled here in 1920. But on Friday, a bulldozer demolished more than a century of community and history in a matter of moments, with barely any warning.
I was born in this community, I grew up there, I married there.
52-year-old Yemi Oladapo is sitting on a nearby curb with two of her three children, next to what's left of their belongings.
I'm down, I don't even know where to go, where are we sleeping, I don't even know with my children. I'm a single mother.
She said officials from the Lagos state government arrived here 2 weeks ago, marking the houses with 15-day demolition notices.
That's what we have been hearing, that those violence and...
A local traditional ruler with influence in the government called Obaoto claimed he was the owner of the land and was bent on taking it back, she said. Officials from the Lagos state government reassured the community that the demolitions would be postponed as recently as yesterday. But on Friday morning, they woke to scores of police officers, state officials, and young men known as area boys carrying clubs and machetes, ordering them to leave immediately.
So we are homeless now. Nowhere to stay. Nowhere to sleep. You can rent. Our apartment rented now is very high now.
45-year-old Albert Bamidele is next to her and is frantic, pacing up and down in anger. He said the community trusted the government's assurances until it was too late.
They're going to fail us because we tell all we could to play with the government to give us the time so we can be able to...
Residents have suffered threats of eviction for years, like many waterfront communities in Lagos, where powerful interests are eager to move in and build on prime real estate.
I could not take anything. My computer system, everything was crushed. My property was crushed inside there.
Police, state officials, and dozens of young men armed with machetes and sticks patrol the settlement. When I'm caught talking to residents by a man carrying a machete, I'm grabbed and led away to our vehicle. But the last person I speak to is 62-year-old Adito Bangbade, sitting on the roadside near her mattress, her fan, and bags of clothes, documents, and pictures. She weeps and says in Yoruba, where is she supposed to go? She was born here, in Ilaje Otumara, but now has lost everything. She says the government comes here every election cycle to canvass for votes and give locals money and food. But that same government has now destroyed their lives. The government is oppressing us, she says. They're oppressing us. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. President Trump has now announced, then delayed, new tariffs several times. And if fully implemented, they are expected to lead to much higher prices, which would be bad for the U.S. economy. But many business leaders say they're optimistic. NPR business correspondent Maria Aspin reports.
American businesses are feeling the whiplash of President Trump's new tariffs against Canada, Mexico, and China.
Just listen to CNBC this week.
The president said those 25% tariffs will go into effect tomorrow.
The White House will be giving automakers, any cars in North America, a one-month delay on the tariffs that they had just announced this week. A major tariff relief coming for Mexico at this point. The president.
So corporate America, like the rest of us, doesn't know what to expect. On Wall Street, markets swung up and down this week.
Businesses don't like uncertainty.
Anna Tavis runs NYU's Department of Human Capital Management, where she talks to executives across corporate America. And as she points out, there's been a lot of uncertainty. Some businesses are really worried about the tariffs becoming permanent, especially the automakers, retailers, and other consumer-facing companies that would be directly affected. This week, Best Buy CEO Corie Barry warned that price increases for American consumers are, quote, highly likely.
We've never seen this kind of breadth of tariffs, and this, of course, impacts the whole industry.
Yet at the same time, business leaders have been saying they feel pretty great about the economy in general. In fact, CEO confidence is at a three-year high, according to the Conference Board. It regularly polls the heads of the largest U.S. companies. And it finished its latest survey on February 10th, after Trump had first announced, then first delayed, the details of his new tariffs.
I know people were surprised that we see this increase in CEO confidence. At the time, the tariffs may have a negative impact on the economy.
That's Stephanie Guichard. She's a senior economist at the Conference Board. And she says that many of the CEOs surveyed said they were worried about tariffs, but they're more focused on Trump's other business-friendly promises.
They are not thinking so much about tariffs. They are thinking about deregulation. They are thinking about lower taxes.
Take Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon. When he talked to CNBC right after Trump's inauguration, he called the impact of tariffs, yep, uncertain. But he also said this.
The U.S. economy is in pretty good shape, and it's not going to be a smooth, perfect path. But people are optimistic that we are going to run a more growth-prone agenda.
Meanwhile, NYU's Tavis points out that there are big risks and limited rewards for executives who publicly criticize Trump or his policies. And in general, she says, part of a CEO's job is to project confidence in their own businesses, in the markets, and in the broader economy.
They have no control over what the government is going to do, regardless of how they feel. Obviously, they want to be on the winning side of whatever happens.
So CEOs have good reasons to look for the upside, while they and everyone else waits to see what actually happens next. Maria Aspen, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Earlier this year, a group of elite former Navy divers and special operations veterans gathered for a secret mission at a safe house in the Florida Panhandle. Okay, just kidding. It wasn't a safe house. It was actually an Airbnb, and the mission wasn't so secret at all. It was a group called Force Blue, which does coral reef restoration and other ocean conservation work, providing what they call mission therapy to veterans who miss the camaraderie and the sense of purpose they got while in the service. NPR's Quill Lawrence joined them and sent us these voices.
It's kind of full circle because, you know, here we are, a force, a military force that's trained for basically weapons of mass destruction, and here we are, weapons of mass construction.
Angel Fiore was a Navy diver for 10 years. Now he helps other vets use the same skill for ocean conservation.
These guys are the best trained divers in the world. We take their skills that they learned from the military, repurpose them for conservation work in all these projects, ranging from coral restoration to marine debris cleanup to building a living shoreline defense system.
Today, it's building a natural living shoreline, which starts with dozens of volunteers carrying tons of stone out into the water of Choctawahatchee Bay near Fort Walton Air Force Base in Florida.
You know, we are a military town. We, you know, where other people might complain about the sounds of loud jets going overhead.
Radio journalists complain.
Right. We love that. We embrace that. That's the sound of freedom. We love our military guys. We get a lot of help from them. We love working with Force Blue. They come and they bring a whole lot of energy. They're a lot of fun.
Allison McDowell directs the Choctawahatchee Basin Alliance, which invited Force Blue here to help build a seawall, which oysters will attach to, oysters that can filter millions of gallons of water in the bay.
Living shorelines are kind of a nature-based infrastructure or a nature-based solution to erosion that can take the place of a seawall. So what we do is we go in and create oyster breakwaters. Today we're using limestone rock, and we're creating 3 50-foot reefs. So it looks like we're doing hard labor. We're putting the rocks.
It's actually science.
The people doing the hard labor, they know they're unusual converts to environmentalism.
My name is Steve Gonzalez, nicknamed Gonzo, retired Navy SEAL Master Chief and Force Blue Special Operations Director. We're transitioning from the warrior to the warrior conservationist, and I don't want this to sound arrogant, but a scientist can say, hey, we've got to do a better job of caring for our coral reefs because they provide a lot of oxygen. Yeah, whatever, you're a Birkenstock-wearing hippie, right? The Navy SEAL says the same thing word for word. They go, oh, man, we've got to take a better... Yeah, they appreciate the fact that we're their mouthpiece now. We're making conservation cool because in the end, it doesn't matter if you get it from the left side of the boat or the right side of the boat. We're all in the same boat to care for this planet.
Gonzo served 34 years, lots of that time underwater and mostly in the dark. And get this, he never knew scuba diving was supposed to be fun.
I got out in 2016. I went in 1982 and got retired in 2016. No lie, I'd actually never seen colors in the water because I was always diving, you know, 10 o'clock, midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, and water, you can barely see your hand in front of your face. So to see that, see the colors, see the vibrant colors, to be in warm water with amazing visibility, nobody trying to hunt you down, you know? Yes, it was definitely different. But also as we're planting the coral, though, you plant that coral, you'll go back and get another piece from the scientist. And by the time you come back to that planting site, there's already marine life checking it out, like curious and everything. And you can see the impact that you're making right then and there to the marine environment, and to our planet. I use the term transcendent, you know, because it is. Like, it really is moving.
And Gonzalez never knew which of his buddies might need this kind of thing, too.
A great friend of mine, we served together at one of the SEAL teams, and he said, I'd love to come check that out. He's in the van, and within a half an hour, he says, Gonzo, you have no idea how much I need this. And I was like, what are you talking about, man? You're well-adjusted, you're doing great. He says, I just miss being part of something special. And unfortunately, when guys start to struggle a little bit, not being part of something special, missing that now what, that's when problems arise. The pressure starts to kick in, the pressures of transitioning and everything, and we do have a suicide problem in special operations communities, I'm sure you know.
Transition from military service has been flagged as a time when suicide and mental health issues spike. And that's not only for veterans who saw combat. A crisis can hit anyone, even if they never went to war.
For you, transitioning out of the military, was that, how did that go?
It pretty much the way it goes for a lot of guys. You're struggling a bit, you grow out your beard, you gain 15 pounds, you make some relationship mistakes, you forget about your family and all the hardship you put them through while you were in the military, and now you do it to them again by just disappearing.
Nathan Quinn was a Special Forces medic, but never deployed to war. When he came to his first Force Blue mission, they told him he needed to get a mental health checkup as part of the deal. At first, he said no way. Sure, he was feeling a bit lost, without purpose, but he wasn't shell-shocked.
I didn't deserve the support of the VA. I didn't deserve the support. I didn't lose my legs. I hadn't gotten shot.
The folks leading the trip said no mental health screening, no dive. Turns out Quinn was struggling, and Force Blue got him some care. Now he comes back because he says healing the ocean and the living coral, that's its own kind of therapy.
I was definitely lost at sea, and Force Blue's been an incredible boon. It's absolutely changed my life. It really is a swords to plowshares kind of thing, and you're also basically giving your lifeblood to this creature that you've only just met. I mean, these are just absolutely stunning, bright colored coral. And by building those reefs back, we can actually prevent the amount of devastation for the next storm. And that's sort of the neat thing about Force Blue overall. It's an idea of taking people who have a hard time with the transition as they come off the service and placing their somewhere where we can thrive, and so there's a certain parallel there with the coral as well.
This was supposed to take 2 days, but the Force Blue folks moved 40 tons of rock by hand and finished mid-afternoon with a lunch break. Oysters will quickly latch onto the rock walls they've built and start filtering the water. Reeds planted behind the new tidal wall will stem erosion and catch runoff.
Last load!
That's Gonzo Gonzalez again, cheering the crew on after breaking their previous record for tons of rock moved in a day.
I've seen all the death and destruction in the world firsthand. And to be able to see something so beautiful as caring for our planet, whether it's outplanting coral or building an oyster bed or rescuing sea turtles or you name it, it truly is moving, and it has given me hope that the world is still a beautiful place, and you just have to find it, and once you find it, become a part of it.
Quill Lawrence, NPR News, Fort Walton Beach, Florida.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated